They wanted to find out exactly what this meditation was. So they asked one of the academics in one of the top universities to go and do some research on meditation. So giving a large sum of money, he went to many meditation masters, you know, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, in East Asia, and being a professor, he had to ask standard questions so he could compare the answers for his research and present the results to the Swedish government. And so eventually he came to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah received him, you know, with some respect, because he was a representative of the Swedish government. And then he asked him what he wanted, and the professor said through a translator that he was going around asking questions on famous meditation masters in the East. Now he came to Ajahn Chah, and if Ajahn Chah would please answer the following four questions. He had four questions, the same questions for everybody. And the questions were, what is meditation? So how do you meditate? Why do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? Those are the four questions. And it's the sort of thing which is great to talk about at the beginning of a retreat. Exactly what is meditation? And how do you meditate? Why? And what do you get out of it? And then Ajahn Chah, he asked somebody for a piece of paper and a pencil, which to me meant he was up to one of his tricks again. This was going to be funny, because he never did things like that, except when he was playing around. And then, when he got the piece of paper and pencil, he even scratched his head. I think he saw Westerners doing that, so he decided to do it the Western way. In Asia, you don't scratch your head when you're answering a question. Then he wrote down his questions, his answers, and the translator said, "Now, Professor, the answer to your first question, what is meditation?" The Venerable Master Ajahn Chah, his answer is this: what is eating? The second question, how do you meditate? His answer is, how do you eat? His third question, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? And the fourth question, what do you get out of meditation? His answer is, you guessed it, what do you get out of eating? And at that, the professor got very angry. He said, I can't give those answers back to my government. And Ajahn Chah said, I'm sorry, sir, that's all you're getting. And that's all he ever gave him. But it wasn't just a joke. That was the great thing about being with such great teachers. What they said was funny, and it was not what you expected, but it was very accurate and very meaningful. Because, how do you eat? What is eating? Has anybody ever told you that? But you'd been doing pretty well over the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years without really knowing what you're doing, because it's a natural process. And this is one of the most important parts of that story. Meditation is a natural process. So you don't have to force it. Just like eating, if you force it, think, I have to eat this way, I have to eat that way, instead of just letting nature tell you when you're full and how much you need or what type of food you need. If you allow nature to tell you how to eat, you usually get much healthier, you eat much better. And it's the same in a why. It's obvious, because food is essential for the health of the body. And meditation is essential for the health of the mind. We're not just bodies, we're minds. In fact, we're more mind than body. And because of that, if you want a healthy mind, meditation is the best health food. It's one of the reasons why living in a very wealthy societies where there's so much food, even in Jhana Grove, how much stuff was there for breakfast? Everything was there just about. So we live in land of plenty materially, but why have we got so many mental sicknesses, depressions, anger, guilt, sort of grief, all of those mental obsessions, sicknesses, are signs that our mind is very, very unhealthy. Just like I remember as a young man seeing these photos of mostly children from places like Africa where there was great famines. So much poverty there, so unhealthy in the body. And if we could take a picture of human beings' minds in the West, there would be just as much suffering, probably more, than people who are living in famine areas, because we live in a famine of the mind. In other words, there's so much sickness and ill health from the human mind. And that, of course, manifests also sicknesses in the body as well. It's not just a case of eating healthy. It's also having a healthy mind as well. It's important for your strength and well-being. And the classic story of this, please excuse me for those who are into health food, but this is a true story of Ted, who was an English man from the north of England, and he lived in the age when no one knew that smoking was bad for your health. So he would smoke like everybody else. And unfortunately, later on in his life, he had to pay the price by getting lung cancer. And of course, he had all the best treatment you could possibly expect in a country like Australia. But in the end, nothing was working. And so they sent him to the hospice in Murdoch in South Street. And when they sent him to the hospice in Murdoch in South Street, he was actually just opened. He was one of the first people there. And I went to see him, and he told me this great story that, now, is that been in Murdoch for a couple of days in the hospice. He said the first evening, the nurse came and asked him what he wanted to eat for dinner, at which he replied, "Well, look, I've got high cholesterol, therefore I cannot have anything oily. I have diabetes, I can't have anything sugary. I have hardened arteries, I can't have any salt." And at that, the nurse interrupted and said, "What on earth are you talking about, Ted? The cholesterol is not going to kill you, the cancer is. You're not going to die of diabetes or of hardened arteries. You've only got a few days to live. Cancer's going to get you. You, Ted, can eat whatever you want." And at that, his eyes went wide and his mouth started salivating. "Really? Really?" And he started ordering all the greasiest, sugary, salty foods which he really longed for many years. But his wife would never, ever allow him to eat. And he ate all of his favorite foods he hadn't had for years. And the end result of that, and this is absolutely true, I was there, I saw this, after about 6 days, he was feeling so much better, his cancer went into remission, and he walked out of the hospital. And he had an extra 6 months of life. Eventually, as I often say, he went back to the hospice to die properly the next time. But he had an extra 6 months. Simply because, you know, he was enjoying himself. He gave his mind an uplift of happiness. So never ever underestimate the power of the mind to actually for your health. So that's actually why we meditate, to have a healthy mind to actually to make this body healthy as well. And it's not just that. It also means that it's much more pleasant to have a healthy mind, because much of the suffering in life is not because of the cancers or the arthritis or these other diseases which we get. It is actually the way we react to these things. The mental anguish is far more suffering than anything physical. Because I remember reading, this was one of the stories, I don't get much time to read, but I remember reading this book about this prisoner without a name, cell without a number, by this poor journalist in Argentina, in the time of the junta in Argentina, who got, they call it, disappeared in the middle of the night. He got taken away by secret forces to an undisclosed destination, into some cellar of some military complex where he was tortured, you know, for quite a long time. But fortunately, his contacts managed to get him released, and so he wrote a book about what was happening. And when I was reading this book, what really struck me was that even though, you know, there was a lot of torture going on, which was, you know, gross, but he said the worst pain of all, for all that's maybe 9 or 10 months, you know, underground being electrocuted and all sorts of stuff, was when his jailers handed him a letter from his wife. And he mentioned in the book, he told his wife, he expected this, a good chance this might happen. If this ever happens to me, for goodness sake, do not write. Because he had enough wisdom to know what would happen. Once they gave him that letter, and he read about his family and his wife, the torture was so much worse, because he had something to compare it with. He'd actually lost all the perceptions of life outside the dungeons after so much time. And now when all these sweet memories came in, it made the bitter pain of the torture far, far, far worse. This is because the mind is what makes it worse, not actually the physical pain. The mind is what really tortures us more than anything else. And I also recall one of the first times I went on pilgrimage over to India. I was talking about that yesterday. It was one of the first times the tour went not just to Kathmandu, it also went to Benares to see the river and the burning bodies. I've seen many burning bodies before, much more close up than you see when you go on these Ganges cruises. But you had to go there, because it was a group, you had to come go together. I didn't really want to go. But on the way back, walking from the river to the bus, of course you get accosted by all of the beggars. And many of those beggars were lepers. And you see these poor, incredibly poor young men and young women with leprosy, mostly young men. And it must be a terrible, terrible disease. And of course they came up to someone like me, even though I'm a monk and got no money, tried telling that in English to one of the beggars. They haven't got a clue what you're talking about. And they see you're white, you've come all this way, you're fat, you must be rich. So it's a bit sort of, I wish I could have given them some donations or something. But I couldn't, I didn't have any money. So instead I just, you know, put my arm around one of the lepers and just gave him a hug, and got the most beautiful smile back. I think you know this if you've ever been to such places. I've never seen a smile like that in Australia. But why? Why is there, even though physical poverty, a terrible, terrible disease, how can they have so much mental joy to give someone a big smile like that? Whereas here in Australia, you've got everything and more, and those sorts of smiles are very, very rare to see. And I started thinking about the suicide rate in Australia compared to the suicide rate sort of in Benares. Who's got the highest? You know we have. So really, it's places like Australia which live in poverty. Places like India should actually be sending aid to Australia. They are, they're sending the Dhamma. Because it's not just physical health and material well-being which makes you healthy and long life. It's also this mental happiness as well. So that is one of the great reasons why we meditate, for mental health. But be careful, because meditation, like any other medicine, if you get the wrong medicine, take it the wrong way, oh, medication can be wonderful for you, but it can also kill you. Many medications are poisons. If they take it in the wrong dosage, you're dead. But if they're taken in the right dosage, save your life. Like meditation as well. Do it the wrong way, it can make you more stressed out than when you began. Do it the right way, and you feel a great freedom of mind, healthy mind, happy mind, and a very, very happy body as well. So this is where we should actually use even our intuition to know, what is meditation, how to meditate. If you're getting more tense, more upset, more frustrated, that can't be meditation. You're going about it the wrong way. And this is one of the reasons I try and teach like this. Our problem is we've been so brainwashed living in this Western culture, even those of you who've come from Asia, Western culture has infected the East, that when we want something, we go and get it. We strive for it. And of course, many of you have been very good at that. You know, you've achieved a lot in your life because you put forth effort. You've done the homework at school. You've studied for your exams. You've gone to places like universities and really put in the hours doing the assignments and struggled through the exams. You've gone to work, you've done your career, you've put the extra effort, you've really put a lot of energy into your life, getting a house, getting your relationship together. Oh, you've done so well, most of you. Except for me. I've got no house, no relationship. Well, everything I learned at university I've forgotten. I've got nothing to show. No bank balance. No superannuation, nothing. Some people ask me that. They said, aren't you a bit worried, Ajahn? You've got no superannuation, you're not allowed to take a pension. Aren't you concerned about your future? How are you going to survive? No, my superannuation is called super karma, Ajahn. You made so much good karma. I've got nothing to worry about in my old age. In fact, even today, you know, someone heard me sneeze this morning. Irish sneeze is hay fever. That's all it is. I sneeze because of hay fever, you know, this time of the year. But I do have some medication. I told her straight away, look, I'm taking some medicine. And I said that, and she was a very smart lady. She said, oh, you told me that in case I would give you some more medicine. I said, exactly. Because every time I sneeze, someone would actually give me some medication. Surprised there's not someone here already. Probably because they haven't got to the doctors yet or the pharmacy. But people love giving me medication. That's why I'm very careful. If I do get sick, I usually hide it. You know the old story. I've done that before. I've sneezed or whatever during a talk at Nolamara. This is absolutely true. I've sneezed during a talk. And before the talk is finished, there's about four or five medicines in front of me. They haven't been listening to the talk. They've gone outside, go to the pharmacy, just round the corner, get some medicines, and give it to me afterwards. And it's not just one. If it's just one, maybe that might be okay. But it's four or five different medicines. Because they say, take this. This is herbal medicine. It's really good for you. I had sneeze like that last year, and it fixed it straight away. And then somebody else goes, no, don't take herbal. Ayurvedic. Ayurvedic is the best. Take this and you'll be fine. It doesn't have any sort of bad side effects. So no, that's just quack medicine. This is really good from the pharmacy. You know, it's the standard medicine. You take this. And this, people are just so, they've gone to all that trouble to get the medicine for you. They paid all this money. And I feel so guilty if I don't take it. So I take some of each. And that really makes me sick. I've done that before, stupid monk. Don't do that anymore. But that's because that's my superannuation, just kindness. But instead of that, you just have a good meditation and then that sort of solves a lot of problems. So that is one of the reasons why we meditate. Now put aside, you know, wisdom, enlightenment, nirvana, all that sort of stuff. Just the standard good health. It's very important. And so that also, when you meditate a lot, you never feel guilty when your mobile phone goes off in public. You can actually let it go straight away. You don't get embarrassed. It just happens. Why is it that people, oh, my mobile phone, what can people think of me? We all do that from time to time, so don't really worry about that. So when you get good mental health, because you meditate, oh, life is so sweet for you. Even things like your work. People have told me now, years ago, when I first came to Perth, if you said you meditated to your boss or when you apply for a new job. They think you're crazy, you're an idiot, you're some weirdo. And so they wouldn't give you the job. But, you know, if you said you went down to the pub every week, oh yeah, you get the job in Australia. But these days, people tell me, they actually put down in their CV that they meditate regularly. And when the boss interviewing you for the job, she says, oh, you meditate, really? I ask you a question, how much do you meditate, what do you actually do? And that is a huge plus. So, you know, you get preferred for the job. And it's obvious the reason why, because it is now well known, well established that people who meditate can handle stress, they don't get so angry and upset, their productivity goes up. It is so well known now that if you go and do some meditation, that is a huge plus for your employability. So try that. Certainly it worked for me. I got many invitations for jobs in many Buddhist societies all over the world. I'm very highly employable. Too much so. But it also, as some of the monks and nuns over in California say, this was actually before Obamacare. It's probably gone now. Now the great Mr. Trump is in office. But that everyone had to have a health care plan in the United States. And that's very expensive. But they were saying that if you put down in your private health insurance, you meditate regularly, that's a huge reduction in your premium. Everybody knows that if you meditate a lot, your health improves enormously. So, it's a great plus. In fact, it's so well known that meditation improves people's health, both physical and mental. It is about time that the Australian Department of Health actually sponsored these retreats. By you coming on this retreat, we're saving the Australian government thousands of dollars because you're not getting sick. And those of you from New Zealand, you can get the New Zealand government to chip in a few dollars here and there. Because it is well known that it's very good for your health. So that's actually why we meditate. And yeah, you may be coming here because you want to get enlightened and get jhanas and all this amazing spiritual stuff. Yeah, but everything is connected in this sense and your health is really, really important. It is hard to meditate with a sick body. It can be done. I've done it before. And if you don't know that story, having typhus fever in a hospital in Ubon, please indulge me telling the old stories, because I love telling these stories. Even though if you've heard them before, I don't care. I'm going to tell it. With typhus fever in Ubon Hospital. They only had one hospital in those days. And in that hospital, there was the monk's ward. And the monk's ward was just this big, long corridor with maybe 6 beds on either side, maybe about 12 monks there. And it was just like, you know, just like the last century. I mean, sort of the century before the last century. It was so primitive. Because even then, that was a third world country. And the northeast of Thailand was the whoop-whoops of a third world country. And so it was very, very basic. And to give you an idea of how basic it was, when I went there, first of all, and they bunged the intravenous drip into my arm, it's usually because you were monks, you didn't need the anaesthetic. They just bunged it in there. Thank you very much. That was a nice introduction. But usually feeling so sick, it didn't really matter. And the next thing, they put you in the bed there, you know, with a few monks on either side. And at 6 p.m., there's a big clock in the ward, they had a nurse's station at the front. Just a little desk with somebody on there, usually reading a newspaper. And at 6 p.m., the male nurse disappeared. 6:30, 7 o'clock. No one had replaced him. So I actually said, I had enough time to say to the monk in the next bed, what about the night nurse? Shall we try and tell someone the night nurse hasn't turned up? And that's when he told me, he said, night nurse? There are no night nurses in the monk's ward. If just something happens to you in the middle of the night, that's just Bad karma, that's all. That did not reassure me one bit. I wanted to go home to a real hospital. That was very rough. You know, 12 hours of the day. He did do a 12-hour shift from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. For 12 hours of the day, there's no one looking after you or monitoring you at all. These were really sick monks. If something went wrong, just tough luck. So, my treatment. They didn't know what I had. Some fever. So they just gave you a cocktail of antibiotics, hoping one of them might work. And it was given in the backside, in the bum, twice a day. Now, that's not so bad these days, because you got high-tech needles, super sharp, only used once. In those days, they would have recyclable needles. They couldn't afford to get a new needle every time. So, and I was pretty sure this is true, they would use them in Bangkok first of all, because that was the capital, and then they'd ship them up to the provinces, cut price, cheap. And they probably use them for everyone else first of all, and the monks last of all, because again, we were the tough guys. And that's pretty accurate, because the nurse, I would never forget, amazing, I can visualize her now. This nurse, who actually did the injections morning and evening and afternoon, she's not like, you know, the idea. I've been in these hospitals giving talks recently. And sometimes in these Thai hospitals, the nurses are nice and petite and pretty. Not this one. This one, I compared her to like a water buffalo. So quiet. That's what she looked like. And that's, she was so big, she had muscles on her. She could have been an Olympic weightlifter. Because she had to be. And the reason was, she never injected you. Bang, stabbed you. Every morning and afternoon. That really hurt. That's the only way you get the needle to penetrate your skin. That really hurt. And I was a very good meditator, very kind monk. I love loving kindness meditation, but for all my abilities, there's no way I could give her any loving kindness at all. I hated that lady. It wasn't her fault, but you know, what can you do? But anyway, there you were, 3 or 4 weeks in hospital with a fever. And it was just one day, I just got so depressed. So fed up, you know, being sick for such a long time, really low energy. Oh, gee, what am I doing this for? But instead of doing anything stupid, when I get into any sort of trouble, always look at the Dhamma. All this Buddhism, it actually works. So go and find some Dhamma, something which works. And for me, what worked was meditation. Ah, to heck with the body, I'm just going to meditate. Absolutely no energy, laying in the bed, feeling terrible, decided just to let go. You can always let go. You can't always do stuff. You haven't got any energy to do stuff. But you can always let go of complaining, let go of worrying, let go of fear, and just to eventually just watch the breath. It's a really nice deep meditation. And it proved to me, I've never been that sick before, and I've never been that sick since. Probably that's the sickest I've ever been. But you can still get into the deepest of meditations from that point. So look, having a healthy body is great, but it's not absolutely necessary. You can always make peace, be kind, be gentle, you can always let go. And that was just an eye-opener for me. So when I say these things, I'm not just saying it's a theory, this actually works. But it's great having a healthy body. And also, look, when you do get into some of those really deepest meditations, they have amazing effects. I wish I would had known much more, but I'm pretty sure it's about right. That's probably when the fever broke and it started to get better. Simply because the power of meditation is amazing, just how it affects your whole body and actually gets you sort of healthy again. So many experiences of that. So, you may come here for many, many different reasons. Health is an important one. So you can be really, really healthy and strong and do whatever you need to do in your life. So that's one of the reasons we meditate. But of course, how we meditate, The meditation method, which is good for your health, is the one which is good for your mental health, which is the one which is good for deep meditation, which is the one which is good for deep insight, which is the one which is good for happiness, which is the one which is good for enlightenment itself. It's all the same meditation. You don't do meditation for health, one thing, meditation for enlightenment, something else. It's exactly the same process. Learning how to be still. That is the main description. What is meditation? It is the ability, the process, which makes the mind and the body become still. Never, I get this out of the way, every meditation retreat I have to say this, please never say the word concentrate. Concentrate just makes you more stressed. Takes too much force. And the joke I say every retreat, if you're trying to concentrate, and if you think this retreat is about concentration, then what does this retreat become? A concentration camp. With all of the connotations of those terrible, terrible places. And there's some retreats are like concentration camps, I've been told. People are just forced so much. And unfortunately, that every time, every month or so, you come across people who have been really hurt, gone psychotic because some of those very forceful retreats. And I'm really concerned about that, because when those retreats are so forceful, they tell you when to get up, how long to meditate, when to walk, when to sit. They become so oppressive that some people actually crack. And when they do, they have to end up going to, in Perth, it's called Greylands. You know, they go psychotic. And that is just really, really bad. So be very careful. You don't need to do such hard work, such struggle, such striving. The way to meditate is to work with your body and mind, not against it. Right? Be mindful and be kind. That is the way we become still. And you know the signs of stillness. Your body relaxes. It feels really easy. When you are concentrating, stressed out, you get headaches, you get aches, you get pains. You can actually feel the body tightening up. And quite frankly, if that goes on for too long, you get cancers. That's how I see it. It's not just toxins in the environment. Yeah, that's probably a contributing factor, but it's also the tension and tightness of modern day life. Striving and struggling so hard. And some people just, they break. Their body just starts to lose its strength and resilience. And you get all these diseases. So be careful of that. When you learn how to relax, because meditation is all about stillness, not concentration, it means you don't have to be someone who's got great willpower. In fact, willpower becomes your enemy after a while. And you start to see that. It's wisdom power is what makes one successful in meditation. Wisdom power, never willpower. Willpower can get you some places, but it can never get you into deep meditation. Wisdom power can. So wisdom power is, how does your body feel right now? That's wisdom power. It's the mindfulness together with wisdom. How do you feel? And the wisdom is, what makes you more relaxed? What makes you more tense? You can actually feel that. That's what I was saying last night. The mindfulness, starting off with your body. Be mindful enough, you start to know what makes your body more tense, what makes it relaxed. What makes it more healthy? What makes it more sick? You can actually feel that. The mindfulness, when it's put on your body, allows you to get feedback. That's its purpose. It's not just to be aware for awareness's sake. It's awareness so you can get to understand how this body works, and especially what makes it more tense, more sick, more stressed, and what relaxes it, what makes it feel good. Where I started developing this from, there was the Stanford professor Whenever I go to conferences and stuff, when I go and speak, I also listen, and you get lots and lots of new stories from these conferences. And this professor, he was at a conference over in Sydney some years ago, many years ago now, from Stanford University, he did an experiment in his psychology class. And the experiment was taking as many students as he possibly could find, giving them credits for taking a day out to be the victims of his experiment. They called them sample, I called them victims. But he split them into half, the control group and the victim group. And the victim group, he sent them to a one-day meditation retreat. But one of the strict forms, you know, get up a certain time, meditate for an hour, walk for 10 minutes, whatever. He sent them to a meditation retreat for one day. And the other half, chosen at random, he sent to a quite expensive California spa for the day. Hot baths, massages. So what, I don't know, I've never been to a spa, but anyway, I think, you know what happens there, maybe many of you have. It was a spa for the day. And when they came back afterwards, he gave them a standard psychology test to see, to find out who was more relaxed, the ones who went to do meditation or the ones who went to a spa. And the results were very, very clear, no doubt at all. So the ones who went to the spa were far more relaxed than the ones who did meditation. What type of meditation are you doing to get so tense that you can't even outdo a spa in relaxation? Certainly not this type of meditation you're learning here. This type of meditation, I will guarantee you get more relaxed than going to a spa, and it's also much cheaper. But why was that? Because the type of meditation is in too much willpower, getting too stressed. That stress, that tightness of God really should have nothing to do with meditation at all. Even I say, follow your intuition, like eating. You know the right food to eat. Sometimes you can taste it and you know that this is important. Now, years and years before I knew too much about health, now, when I first went to India to go on pilgrimage, which was 1972 or something, I didn't really know what I was doing, but I thought as a Buddhist, I should go there. And went overland, you know, because too poor to get an aircraft. And as soon as I arrived in India, I had, like many people in those days, had terrible, terrible diarrhea. So I spent one day in a hotel just sitting on the toilet, basically. And I didn't really know about, you know, making sure I wasn't dehydrated. But so I drank lots of water, but then I had this incredible craving for salt. And so the first thing I did when I could actually walk was go outside the hotel, go to a shop and buy a big bag of salt and start munching it. And I didn't know why. It's only later on when people said, yeah, when you have diarrhea, it's not just losing water, it's losing your salts as well. And just, it was actually quite surprising afterwards. Just intuitively, I knew I needed salt. That's why I took it. Or like this other story which I read in a newspaper or a magazine, about this kid. Once it was born and could crawl, it would always go for anything with salt in it. Even the little shaker which had salt in on the table, as soon as it could crawl, it would go for the salt and start munching the salt. So mother had to go and put everything with salt on in a high place so the kid, the baby, could not reach it. Because the kid was just shoving salt in its mouth. And the kid died. And when they gave the autopsy, they found the child had this very rare disease, which was that it couldn't metabolize salt, and it needed that salt. The kid knew what it needed. But the mother thought, oh, salt is bad for you. But in that case, the salt was actually going to save the kid's life. So sometimes you have an intuition, you know, even just what you need. If you need to sleep more, need to exercise more, eat this or eat that. You can actually feel it sometimes if you are mindful of your body. And that really can keep you in really, really good health. So listen to your body. By which I mean being mindful of it. And then you can feel this is what it really needs. Of course, we all think, no, my body needs training. My body needs discipline. My body needs to be told what it should be done. Who knows what it should be done? Don't follow other people. You just listen to yourself. Listen to your body. And it gets very, very healthy that way. So, and if you, argument for this, my proof of this, ask the monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery, who's the healthiest monk in this that monastery? Who's the one who never gets sick and goes to hospitals and doctors and stuff? And they say, Ajahn Brahm, I don't know why. Look at the food he eats, but I don't know, but he never goes to doctors or needs to go to hospitals or never gets flu or never gets stuff like that. All these other monks do. Anyway, I call them sickos. Got a lot of sickos in my monastery. Really joking. But if you listen to your body, you can actually feel it and work with it. So that's one of the great benefits of meditation. And how to meditate, again, listen to the body. Be mindful of it. And when the body tells you it needs something, then do it. Tells you it needs water, drink it. Don't just try to say, no, I'm not going to take water now. It's not allowed. Do it, for goodness sake. And the same thing which happens when you're watching your mind. Yesterday, really important Dhamma teaching about how peaceful are you? How agitated are you? Agitation, to me, is like the opposite of peace. And for sometimes, people, they meditate, and they meditate on the breath, or they meditate on the body, but they don't actually watch. Are they getting peaceful, or are they getting more tense? Which one is it? Because they're missing the main point of meditation. The breath is a vehicle, just like a car. But just driving a car is not good enough unless you're going in the right direction. Yeah, I'm driving my car, but I'm going backwards over a cliff. But you're driving the car. Yeah, I'm watching my breath, but I'm going backwards into a heart attack. So, yeah, it's not watching the breath or watching the body. What is important is, what direction is it going in? Is it going to more peace, more stillness, or more tension? So don't just think, yeah, I'm just watching the breath, it must be good. No, the breath is just a tool, a vehicle. If there is a purpose why we meditate, what we're trying to get out of it, stillness, peace, relaxation, and that's something you can feel. So if you're going to be mindful of anything on this retreat, the breath, useful, body, really useful, but what's really most crucial is peace. Are you peaceful? What you're doing, is it making you more peaceful or more agitated, more tense? And once you become mindful of that, that gives you a far better indicator of whether you're going in the right direction or the wrong direction or not. Signs of going in the wrong direction, getting irritated really easy. The person, bang the door. I'm going to really tell them off. I'm going to leave them a note because I'm not allowed to talk. And people actually do leave people notes. It's a crazy thing to do. Writing down a note is just as bad as actually telling them face to face. Because of your thinking, it's wasting too much energy, too much time. So instead, they bang the door, they get up early and make themselves a cup of coffee and ding, 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 ding in their cup. So, yeah, if you are going in the wrong direction, you get very irritated. If you're going in the right direction, you're so peaceful. Like snoring. People have actually asked me, can we have a list in the retreat center of the notorious snorers? Because people get to know who they are. So we can put them all in the same cottage. Like, you know, in the old days, like smoking areas and non-smoking areas. This is the snoring cottage for all those who really snore. And those who don't snore. So, you know, if you smoke and disturb one another. Because no matter what you do, you try and make this retreat center as comfortable as possible, but of course there's always some snoring, or sometimes, you know, you have a shower, turn the water, flush the toilet, and some of the plumbing just rattles. There's always some noises somewhere which, you know, no matter what you do, you just can't get rid of. So this story was of one of my monks, and I'm very proud of him because, you know, at least someone actually listens and follows instructions, and they work. His brother was coming to visit. And many of you know that Bodhidharma Monastery is just really full up. It's so hard to get a place to stay there. As soon as, like, someone leaves, another two people come. That's about what it's like. So you can never find enough accommodation over there. So I told him, yeah, your brother can come, but there's no place he can stay. He said, oh, he can stay with me in my room. The kuti rooms are very small. They're 3 meters long by 2.4 meters wide. Just have a tiny room. Just enough to put your bed and a few other little things, a little table, but not much at all. And so that I said, well, you know, you can fit in there, but I'm sure, knowing your age, one of you is going to snore. Are you prepared for that? He said, yeah, no trouble at all. I've got my plan. My plan is to go to sleep first. Which is always a trick. If you go to sleep first before anybody else snores, then your snoring keeps them awake so they can't snore and wake you up. That's you're not very compassionate, but it works. But, of course, his brother went to sleep first and started snoring really loudly in the same room. And so what did he do? He remembered great Ajahn Chah's teaching, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. What does that mean? It's all the things he adds on to the snoring. Oh, they shouldn't do this. Why did he have to do this? I'm not going to get asleep. I'm going to be up all night. What's going to happen if I get up all night? I won't be able to, you know, do anything in the morning. I feel terrible all day. That is the biggest noise. You know how it resonates inside your mind. So he decided not to disturb the noise. And how he did this, he knows that it's what you add on to these noises which is the main disturbance. That's what means disturbing the noise. So he decided to add some good stuff onto the noise instead of the bad stuff to make it a positive experience rather than a negative one. So he started using his perception, his imagination, to start regarding the snoring as one of the most beautiful, sonorous, experimental, state-of-the-art, cutting-edge symphonies. He started regarding it as music. Now, for some of you, modern music might appear as just disgusting, as disturbing, as snoring, like a rap music, like a death metal, or whatever it is, gangster rap, or what, I don't know. But anyway, sometimes people get very upset with modern music. Other people love it. It's just the way you look at it, that's all. So he decided to change the way he looked at the snoring. Until he said it didn't take him long, about 5 or 10 minutes, and the snoring became so melodious. It was just so interesting. It was so wonderful. And that's the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning, having had a good night's sleep. Just changing his perception solved the problem, and he went to sleep very peacefully. That's the Dhamma. That's how the meditation works. So you have noise, change your perception of it. A door bangs, and oh, it's reminding me to be mindful. Click, 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 click. It's just like a temple bell in Japan somewhere. Ding, 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 and your cup. Just like a temple bell. Whatever it is. When you change your perception, the whole thing changes. And now you can actually be still. It works. And so now you're actually learning, because you're watching the peace index rather than the irritation index, what makes the mind more peaceful? Which means that you develop more and more peace, less and less irritation. You become calmer, more still human beings. Because you're watching the right thing. And if any time you get disappointed, frustrated, that means your peace index has gone way to the other end, gone to agitation. It's not that your, you know, the meditation is so not working, or the place is too busy, or it's too cold or too hot. No, it's your attitude is a problem. So you're frustrated. So notice the frustration. What lessens the frustration? The agitation, known as frustration, what makes it less? Just letting it be, leaving it alone. Frustration is part of life. All comes because of expecting things which I couldn't get. So, not expecting anything. And then your frustration level goes down, down, down. You become peaceful. You become calm. You're becoming still, which is what the purpose of meditation is. It is from stillness that everything else comes. The wisdom born of stillness, the health born of stillness, the freedom which comes from stillness, and the great bliss which comes from stillness. That stillness, in part, is called samadhi, stillness. That is what we're developing here. Peace. Peace of mind. And you'll find you don't need to be in the perfect meditation center. You don't need to be with people who never snore. You don't need to have the food that you really like. You don't need to have teachers who tell new stories every day. Teachers tell the old stories. You can make peace with everything. That is, I finish off, when one person once came to me and said, Ajahn Brahma, what happens when you're really sick? I mean, hospital sick, with all these tubes inside of you. What should I do to meditate then? Because I can't meditate when I've got all this stuff in me and feel really awful and painful and I can't even breathe properly. And my answer was, it's a very good answer, I'm very pleased with that answer. I said, well, even in hospital, in really, really sick, you know, can you make peace with what's happening? Can you make peace with the pain? Can you make peace with the tiredness? Can you make peace with the discomfort? Or do you always have to fight it? He said, oh, I suppose, yeah, that's possible. Maybe a tough one, but yeah, I can make peace with it. Can you be kind to it? Open the door of your heart to it? Allow it to be with unconditional acceptance and kindness? Yeah, I can do that. Can you be gentle? Yeah, of course. Then you can meditate. Because that is the basis of meditation. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. That is what moves that indicator of peace down to a 2 or a 1 or a half or even a 0. That's what makes you peaceful. By making peace. By being kind. By being gentle. You make war. I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to tell that person who snored this morning they should not come to the hall before they wake up. I'm going to tell that person who bangs the doors, I'm going to go and get this foam to put on their door so it never bangs. I'm going to get them a plastic spoon and a plastic cup so it doesn't rattle. I am going to... all that sort of stuff, that actually puts that indicator up to the high levels of irritation. Making peace, not making war. This is Buddhism. Buddhism doesn't do war, except on meditation retreats sometimes. It has kindness. Not this, I hate that person. It has this beautiful gentleness, not force, but gentleness. So that's one thing. How we meditate. Making peace. You can always do that. Being kind. You can always do that. And being gentle. You can always do that. So there's no reason why you can't meditate. Any situation, any circumstance. People aren't stopping you meditating. They're not disturbing your meditation. They can't. No one can disturb you from making peace, being kind, being gentle. They can disturb you from watching the breath. They can disturb you from sleeping, but that's not what meditation is. It's learning how to make peace, be kind, being gentle. And as many of you know, that is the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Samasankappa. Nekamasankappa, Avayapadasankappa, Ahimsakasankappa. The three right motivations. Samasankappa. First one, literally means letting go, nekama. But I sort of say, well, making peace. Give it something which you can do much more easily. So I mention this at the very end of my first talk here, because sometimes people say, okay, Ajahn Brahm, all sounds very good, but what's that got to do with what the Buddha said? I remember actually my previous abbot here, Ajahn Chakra. When he first came from Thailand, he told me this. He gave a talk in Sydney, I think it was. And this professor of Buddhism asked him a question at the very end. He said, all those lovely stories and that nice wisdom, it's all very good, but what's that got to do with Buddhism? It's such a put down by someone who knew the suttas but never practiced them. So I always want to make sure I avoid that criticism by actually quoting some of the suttas in Pali, just to let everybody know that I know what I'm talking about. You can reference everything if you want to find it out. This is actually Buddhism. This is meditation. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Even when someone's snoring in the room next door to you. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with them. Your mind is crazy. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with it. You've got a really bad headache, or you've got hay fever. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with it. And you notice the peace index increases, irritation goes down. All the other stuff in meditation, which I'll talk about later on, will come from that once you have the great foundation. So there you go. It's 9 o'clock, so time to finish the talk for this morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, have a wonderful morning. Usually we have interviews, but not the first day. So interviews will start tomorrow. But today you are totally free to meditate flat out again if you're not still a bit tired, to go for a nice walk, to meditate here, meditate in the rooms, wherever you wish to meditate. The place is yours. Have a wonderful day and see you later on. Oh, I should say that in the evening, for those of you who don't know, from, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock? That's right. Or maybe 9:30, we have the Q&A session. So everybody is invited to write down a question on a piece of paper. And I will attempt to answer it in the evening. So the pieces of paper are usually outside in the lobby area, in the basket, and you write your question down, and I will answer it in the evening. So questions on meditation, questions about Dhamma, or even funny questions as well. You've been meditating all day, it's nice to just have a bit of relaxation. Okay, so have a wonderful day. But you don't have to have a wonderful day. I'm not giving orders. This is not one of those control freak camps. If you want to have a miserable day, I give you total 100% permission to have a totally miserable day today. It's totally up to you. I'm not going to control you.